Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Wednesday, April 22nd, 2015, Earth Day, right after my birthday. And the battle is shaping up over surveillance here in the United States. Every breath you take, every move you make, every bond you break, every step you take, I'll be watching. And every phone call you make. The government is collecting the metadata, the numbers originating the call, receiving the call, how long they talked. That's the metadata that is at issue in at least part of the struggle over the looming renewal of the Patriot Act. And while we here are supporting Congressman Mark Pocan and his Republican counterpart Tom Massey, who've introduced the Surveillance State Repeal Act, it's very clear that the Republican-dominated House and the ever-cautious, surveillance-oriented United States Senate will renew most of the Patriot Act when it expires at the end of May. I'd love to see the entire thing repealed. That's certainly my position. But the current climate in Washington, where on a daily basis the fears are stoked, and routinely I report to you on the dramatized busts of alleged domestic terrorists, and I believe this is part of the script, that the FBI busts these people in an orchestrated effort to gin up fear so that our elected leaders can say, oh, you know, I took an oath to defend the Constitution, but today I think I'm going to take illegal steps that violate the Constitution in a phony effort to protect the American people from relatively modest threats, if they exist at all. And so Mike Rogers, former FBI agent, former member of Congress, Republican who until last year was chair of the House Intelligence Committee, he made statements today citing the arrest in Minneapolis and San Diego of these 19 to 21-year-olds who said they wanted to go join Daesh, the Islamic State, and fight in Syria. Only the news accounts acknowledge the presence of an FBI informant and that nobody knows where they came up with the money to buy their airline tickets. And those are two threads that set off alarms for a guy like me who has seen the pattern of FBI frame-ups in these alleged terrorism cases. So here's Mike Rogers. Now you have a very real face of what the threat is. Somebody calling back from Syria to Minnesota, either recruiting somebody or giving the operational okay to do something. That's real and it's serious. Before, it all seemed hypothetical. Now you can see it. I don't think this is accidental. I mean, after all, Mike Rogers is a retired FBI agent. I'm sure he's hearing from his old colleague saying, hey, Mike, we need a little thunder and lightning here to get another extension of the Patriot Act without any amendments. Here's another quote from Mike Rogers. Think about how many people are in Syria with Western passports or even American passports. Well, let's think about that. Our own government says that that number is no more than a couple of dozen. But that doesn't bother Mike Rogers. He continues, I want to know if they pick up the phone. Now, how stupid does an American who goes to Syria and wants to call the United States and say, I'm coming back to bomb something, or brother, go ahead and blow up a stadium? How stupid does Mike Rogers think they are? I mean, it's pathetic. Every American knows that you can't make an overseas phone call without it likely being intercepted. And a call coming from Syria would certainly be flagged in that manner. So, this drama, this soap opera that passes for commentary on the American situation today is really insulting. But it's effective. And that's really sad. Now we're learning that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell may trump the action in the House, where there are some members of both the Democratic and Republican parties who want to make some honest changes to the Patriot Act. And that includes Section 215, which not only is used to authorize the collection of metadata, but also all of the intrusive national security letters, these self-executed warrants that the FBI has widely abused, according to its own inspector general, harassing librarians and banks and other places where they use Section 215 to pry open our private records. Nadia Kayali, who's been a guest on our program, she's now working with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. She said that NSA defenders will falsely claim that it's necessary to keep the mass surveillance. But the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, the President's Review Group, and senators who are familiar with how bulk phone records collection works have all said we don't need the program. And of course, I don't really consider the efficiency or the efficacy of a program when I evaluate whether it should be allowed or not. To me, the fundamental issue is it constitutional? And I submit, and I'm not alone, that these programs are clearly unconstitutional. Well, the Obama White House used to oppose measures that were burbling up in Congress for a new cybersecurity bill. But because of the Sony hack, the Target hack, the Anthem hack, we're told that the White House has changed its tune, and that as soon as this afternoon, the House of Representatives may pass with a lopsided Republican majority a bill to provide legal liability protections for companies that share cyber threat information with one another or with the government. And we're told to relax because negotiators have added critical privacy protections. If a company shares information with the government, it would receive liability protection only if its data undergoes two rounds of washing out personal information. Do you believe that? Do you trust that? Now, the NSA whistleblowers who I've talked to, in particular, Bill Binney, who was a top technical official at the NSA before he left and became a whistleblower, he has told me repeatedly that the NSA has insisted on very low levels of encryption by commercial websites operated by companies like Target and Home Depot and Anthem that have been hacked, Sony. And the reason is that that makes it easier for the NSA to hack in. And so I don't trust this one bit. The White House has issued a statement that commended the effort, but also said that the liability protections offered to private companies in the House bill would be so sweeping that they might backfire and prevent companies from reporting cyber threats. And they also suggest that safeguards should be added to keep companies from using cybersecurity to punish competitors. And I'm disappointed to hear that Adam Schiff, a Democrat from the Los Angeles area, who had opposed the bill, is now supporting it and is in close contact with the White House to push it through. Our Fourth Amendment is optional, and that option has been widely exercised against our constitutional interests. Now, here's just the latest example of an episode that should be deeply embarrassing to the FBI if it had any shame as an institution. But we covered this story last year. During the World Cup, FBI agents posing as hotel internet repair persons at Caesar's Palace first cut off the internet service to a suspect's hotel room. The suspect called the hotel for some tech support. So they sent Sparky, who was actually an undercover agent. And without a warrant, he used his visit to gather evidence of the illegal gambling operation that the FBI suspected. Well, I'm glad to see that U.S. District Judge Andrew Gordon has thrown out all of the evidence gathered during the illegal search of Wei Seng Fua's hotel room at Caesar's Palace. Now, this is important because I don't believe Mr. Fua is an American citizen. And we often set a much lower standard for what are, you know, considered non-citizens or non-U.S. persons. So the case continues, but the evidence has been thrown out. And that's just a little vindication for those of us who believe firmly in our Fourth Amendment rights. A new British report tells us that the nation of Djibouti and a U.S. airbase in Djibouti was a black site that was used for detention, interrogation, and torture. This took place starting in 2003 at Camp Le Manier in Djibouti. And for at least 10 years, Djibouti has hosted the Combined Joint Task Force Horn of Africa there. And we now have full confirmation that individuals were sent there via the U.S. rendition program. That's a nice word for kidnapping by executive jet. And that some of those people, we have proof, were tortured there. And, of course, we don't investigate these issues in the United States because we're looking forward, not backward. But in Britain, the Justice Forum into Djibouti's alleged role in the torture of terrorism suspects is based on U.S. government documents, sworn statements from former detainees, investigations over the last 10 years by human rights researchers, and flight records showing that CIA-linked aircraft flew in and out of Djibouti. And some of this evidence also was contained but somewhat obscured in the Senate Intelligence Committee's review of torture that was released contentiously in December of last year. Now, what we also know is that Djibouti is a base for drone flights. And unlike the report from The Intercept the other day about how Ramstein Air Base is this critical relay point, drones actually take off and land from Camp Le Manier in Djibouti. And they're used to strike in Yemen and Somalia. Now, the key finding for me here is that the Obama administration reportedly continues to send suspects to Djibouti. Now, we know that the president, with a flourish and very prominently, issued an executive order shortly after he took office in 2009, banning the use of black site prisons by the CIA. But there was a little loophole that said it does not apply to facilities used only to hold people on a short-term, transitory basis. Well, my question is, if we render somebody and we hold them in Djibouti short-term, where do they go from there? And that's a question to which I have no answer right now. I want to credit Jason Leopold of Vice News for that report. And Jason also recently reported on the Periodic Review Board. That's kind of the parole board at Guantanamo. And their handling of the case of a Saudi citizen named Abdul Rahman Shalabi. He's now 39 years old. He has been held there and never charged since he was picked up in December 2001. He was held in Afghanistan. He reports he was tortured, but shortly after that, he was one of the early residents of Guantanamo Bay. Now, for some reason, he's considered a high-risk detainee. And so it remains kind of fuzzy and pretty doubtful that the Periodic Review Board will clear him for release. But I think it's an interesting story, and I hope you'll take a moment to follow the link to that article that's in the show file at peterbcollins.com. One other take on Guantanamo and some intriguing news is buried deep in this story in today's Washington Post. The headline reads, "Facing threat in Congress, Pentagon races to resettle Guantanamo inmates." And it recaps some insider information from the Pentagon that in the next few weeks, officials plan to send up to 10 prisoners overseas, probably in June. They hope that all 57 inmates approved for transfer will be resettled by the end of this year. Wow. Now, when you roll that around on your tongue, all of the 57 inmates approved for transfer, well, buried in this article is a reference to Shocker Ammer, whose case we have tried to draw attention to here and supporting the campaign launched by Andy Worthington in London to stand with Shocker Ammer. I told you at the Ai Weiwei exhibit on Alcatraz Island in San Francisco Bay that is just wrapping up that there is a depiction of Shocker Ammer in a tapestry of the world's political prisoners. So, partly in response to David Cameron's plea that was made personally during his visit to the White House in January, it does appear that there's some movement in the case of Shocker Ammer, and there are others whose cases are less well known who can hope that if they have been cleared for transfer, that they might actually wind up leaving Guantanamo before the end of this year. And I certainly hope that happens. But we know that Lindsey Graham and Kelly Ayotte, two Republican senators, have already submitted a bill to tie the president's hands once again. And I hope that Obama will veto such a bill like that and do everything possible to empty out that prison. Now, there are still the ghosts. The men who have never been charged and are told that they will never be cleared for release. And there's somewhere around 50 of those individuals. Now, somewhere below half of those are high-value suspects who have actual cases against them, or at least the outlines of a case. But there are a number of men in limbo, and there is no clear indication what the Obama team plans to do with them. Every day I like to mention a handful of the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. Folks like Mark Brodsky, Jeff Lipinski, Deborah Kennedy, Faith Peoples, and, Faith Peoples. I mention Faith Peoples twice because Faith Peoples is so devoted that she has two monthly subscriptions to the podcast, and she's not the only one. There are other generous people like that, too. And I need to ask you to lend your support to my work here. I don't make a living doing this podcast. It's something I do because, well, it's personal therapy. I need to express myself and share my views with you. But if you value the work that I'm doing, I'd appreciate it if you'd step up and take out your own subscription. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. Under my picture, there's a link that says sign up. Takes you to a page where you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month, or our best deal, the $50 annual subscription. And new annual subscribers earn the ebook edition of Pepe Escobar's Empire of Chaos as our bonus gift. And Pepe has agreed to sit for an interview next week, so we'll be getting his views on the many conflicts and situations around the globe. And I always look forward to talking with Pepe. Well, there's an opening in Washington for the top narc, because Michelle Leonhardt, the head of the Drug Enforcement Administration, announced her retirement yesterday afternoon. After a string of scandals, the latest which shows that DEA agents held parties in Colombia where drug lords paid for the hookers who serviced them. Isn't that a pretty picture? And of course, you know, we're going to see a parade and a theatrical effort to clean up the DEA, and they're going to find a new crusader rabbit to take the place of Michelle Leonhardt. But it's all bogus. And, you know, I invite you to look critically for the voices of any elected officials who say, well, you know, maybe we ought to dismantle the DEA. Maybe we ought to end this crazy war on drugs because, well, the big war right now is within the DEA and all those crazy partying agents abusing their authority, abusing taxpayers' trust in them. But if you hear anybody call for the dismantling of the DEA, would you email me immediately, Peter at peterbcollins.com, and I will invite that person to come on the program. And we can share that point of view together. I've withheld comment on the situation in Baltimore and the death of Freddie Gray because I've been waiting for more substantive information to surface. And you probably know the outlines. He was a black man. He was picked up in a drug area. He ran from the cops. They handcuffed him and put him into a van. 30 minutes later, when he arrived at the booking site, I guess a police office or a police station, he was dead. And he died from a fatal spinal cord injury. Now, that takes some doing. And so far, I haven't seen any significant videos that have surfaced of the events of April 12th. But the cause of death alone, the spinal cord injury, really raises a lot of questions. You can't do that to yourself. And the only thing the cops have admitted to is that during the van ride, at one point the cops stopped the van and they shackled Gray's legs because they felt he was becoming irate. And the police commissioner has added that Gray asked for an inhaler and several times asked for medical care. Now, I have to assume that he was beaten, either in the van or before they popped him in there. Six officers have been suspended. I hope we get to the bottom of this one. Well, there is a walkout of food service workers today at the United States Capitol. And the one percenters, they're not all one percenters, but there are a whole lot of them, who populate the House and the Senate, may be feeling just a little pressure and a little shame. Because the people who serve them in the Senate dining room and the House dining room, and I've been a guest in each one of those on occasions in the past, they don't get paid very well. And they're not actually government employees. It's been outsourced to third-party contractors. And I only have one citation here, but there is a janitor who's been working in the Russell Senate office building for 10 years and is still only making just under $12 an hour. We'll see if these members of the House and Senate have any shame. As we mentioned with the FBI, it's in real short supply inside the Beltway there. Well, yesterday I reported to you something that apparently wasn't true. I told you that Saudi Arabia had suspended its bombing raids on Yemen. And the Saudis did announce that. And then they continued bombing. They hammered Houthi positions in the town of Taiz. That's on the southwest portion of Yemen. And they also have been attacking near the port city of Aden. So it's unclear what the Saudi intentions are. The Houthis have said they're ready for political dialogue as soon as there is a complete end to the aggression against Yemen and lifting of the blockade. Now, Saudi officials had said they were stopping the operation because they had achieved their objectives. And nobody believes that. We know now that there was a great deal of U.S. pressure to get them to suspend. And maybe that led to the PR initiative that wasn't actually reflecting the action in the air and the impact on the ground. The United Nations expert is dealing with the hardliners in Europe and the continuing wave of refugees who are attempting to get across the Mediterranean to Europe. And when you look at the source of the refugees, it appears that many of them are trying to escape the civil war in Syria, now in its fifth year, where millions have been displaced. And for whatever reason, people are taking roundabout ways of getting from Syria to Libya, a failed state that is in daily conflict. Now, why you would trade one miserable situation for another, hoping somehow to escape from Libya and get to Europe, I don't know. I mean, it's hard to put a rational frame around people trying to escape with their lives and the limited information they have and the decisions that they make based on that. But the UN Commissioner for Refugees and Human Rights is asking nations around the world to agree to take in at least 1 million refugees from the Middle East and from Africa. But what I see shaping up is that the Europeans, with a lot of nationalist tensions raging, anti-immigrant sentiments, we know it in France, we know it in Germany, we know it's there in the Netherlands. I think they're going to try to turn Libya, and if you recall, Hillary Clinton advocated setting up a no-fly zone before we took out Gaddafi, a brilliant move, as you know. And I think that instead we're now going to have a no-flee zone. And by cracking down on the smugglers and the ship captains who take hundreds of people at great risk, often on rickety boats, they think that they can stem the flow by locking them down in Libya. Frankly, I don't think that's going to work. A couple of stories coming from Afghanistan today. There have been a wave of kidnappings followed by some beheadings. And the victims are members of a minority group in Afghanistan called the Hazara. Police have confirmed that 4 Hazara farmers were kidnapped and have been found beheaded. Another 6 who had been kidnapped by unknown assailants were also found dead, their bodies dumped. Now, it's complicated here because, as I've pointed out, there are many fighters around the world who've decided to fly the flag of the Islamic State, or Daesh, because they think it gives them more cachet and that they appear, you know, more vicious that way. And so it's not clear if the Taliban is using the tactics of the Islamic State or if a local warlord there, who has pledged allegiance to the Islamic State, Mullah Abdullah Kakar, is actually, you know, taking orders from Syria and fully affiliating with the Islamic State folks in Iraq and Syria. I haven't seen enough evidence to really convince me about that. We'll have to see if that does arise. The other story about Afghanistan is that the new president, Ashraf Ghani, who was in Washington just last week, spent the weekend in Tehran, where he met with the Iranian president, Hassan Rouhani, and signed some security and trade agreements. Now, the security cooperation between Afghanistan and Iran in some ways mirrors the don't ask, don't tell approach that we've taken to the insertion of Iranian militants and Iranian military leaders in our fight against Daesh in Iraq. So I'll try to put this on the scoreboard for you, but currently we tacitly support Iran's involvement in Afghanistan and in Iraq, but not in Yemen and not in Syria. Wow, I think it's hard to keep all this stuff straight, and it'll be interesting to see just what kind of arrangements develop over time between Kabul and Tehran. And finally today, here in California, we've had a squabble since measles broke out at Disneyland a few months back, and there was a wave of infections. And so the State Senate Education Committee in Sacramento held a vote today on a bill that they had hoped to pass a week ago, but it stalled because of virulent opposition led by Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and others who represent parents who do not want to be forced to vaccinate their children. And as I've said before, I believe vaccination is a reasonable thing to do. I've been vaccinated. At the same time, I understand the fears that parents have. There's a brand new study. It looks to be extremely robust and highly credible. 95,000 children were studied. And this study was published just the other day, concluding there is no link between the measles, mumps, rubella vaccination and autism in children. And I find this study persuasive, and I feel fortunate that my kid is in his 30s and I don't have to confront this. But I have to tell you that I have sympathy for parents who do not want to be forced to vaccinate their children in every case. And some of it may be on the unfounded fears that the carrier, the thimerosal that is in some of these vaccines was once linked to autism. But we've got to be fair to these parents that the, you know, massive escalation of diagnoses of autism and autism-related syndromes in the United States and, to be fair, in other countries is alarming. And parents who've had one kid develop autism or autistic symptoms, and in their minds they link it to vaccination, you want to force them to vaccinate their other children? I just think this is one of the ultimate Hobson's choices. And I don't pretend to have the wisdom of Solomon or anybody else to resolve it. But as we see this authoritarian wave essentially saying that your kids can't go to public school if they can't prove that they've been fully vaccinated, it's an authoritarian move that I'm not comfortable with. Thanks for joining me today for my news and comment. This is the free podcast that you're authorized to share with absolutely everyone, vaxxers or anti-vaxxers. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until